The Peter Schiff Show.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Indeed. Indeed knows hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply.
Good evening, everybody. It is 7 p.m. in the evening here in Paris on Bastille Day. I recorded this podcast yesterday, Saturday afternoon, while I was still in Turkey, and I thought I was done. But I woke up this morning to the news that there was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump while I was asleep. And so I thought it was important that I comment on this story. So I'm recording this segment to be the introduction to the podcast that you're about to see as soon as I'm finished discussing this topic. You know, I've talked on this podcast about the fact that I believe that Donald Trump was going to be reelected, that it was, you know, the odds were very strong in his favor. And the one good thing that might have come out of this attempt on Donald Trump's life is I think this assures that he's going to win. I mean, if he wasn't going to win before, he's certainly going to win now. I mean, just that photograph, that iconic photograph of President Trump with a bloodied ear, with his fist raised high in the air, with the American flag waving in the background, could be one of the most famous photographs. And I think that image alone is enough to get a lot of people to vote for Donald Trump. The amazing thing, though, when you look at the coverage that I've seen on this, if you read the mainstream media, most of the early stories didn't even mention the fact that there was an attempt on the president's life, that he was shot. I mean, some of these news headlines are incredible. And of course, a lot of the comments that are coming from the left where they're wishing the president a speedy recovery, I know that's very disingenuous. A lot of the people on the left are upset that the shooter missed. They're not upset that somebody tried to kill Donald Trump. They're upset that the person failed. In fact, there's a lot of people on the left. You can see them all over social media. They're not even hiding the fact that they're upset that the shooter missed. In fact, he didn't miss. I mean, he hit him. He just was off by a bit. But what's even more disturbing about the attempt on the president's life is the fact that this guy was able to position himself on that building so close to where Donald Trump was speaking, where he was supposedly under the protection of the Secret Service. How could they have missed this guy? The building was right across from where the president was speaking. And other than the building that was behind him, it was really the only other vantage point where a sniper would have a clean line of sight on the president. How could the Secret Service detail have missed this guy? And apparently there are a number of people in the crowd who spotted him and who were yelling. Yet you had a couple of Secret Service sharpshooters on the roof behind the president who somehow couldn't see this guy as he was moving towards the president with a gun or a rifle. So there's a lot of questions that need to be answered regarding this particular shooting. But one thing that we shouldn't be surprised at is that somebody did try to kill Donald Trump. After all, the way the media has been vilifying him, he's not only a threat to democracy, he's going to end democracy, but he's another Adolf Hitler. This is how the left describes Donald Trump. If Donald Trump really is an Adolf Hitler, well, sure, someone's going to want to assassinate him. I mean, wouldn't you assassinate Adolf Hitler? Right? I mean, nobody would be upset if Hitler was assassinated, right? They would be congratulating the guy who did it. And so when you have this kind of rhetoric, what else do you expect? In fact, I'm sure that had the shoe been on the other foot, had somebody attempted to assassinate Joe Biden, the media would be having a field day blaming Trump, blaming MAGA Republicans. You see, this is the type of hatred that your divisive radical right wing, agenda is promoting, all the hatred, right? They would be blaming it all on Trump. Well, where is the media blaming the assassination attempt on Trump, on Biden, on the left, for all the hate and all the, you know, the way they described President Trump? In fact, I saw that, I think it was a fundraising call just a week ago, where President Biden said that it's time to put Trump in the bullseye. Now, I know that he didn't mean that literally in the bullseye, mean take a shot at him, but clearly if Donald Trump had said something about putting Biden in the bullseye, right, they would have been all over him. But Biden says it and no one seems to care. But it's especially poignant when, in fact, somebody did literally put Trump in a bullseye and almost killed him. I mean, just a few inches or an inch off. I mean, it grazed his ear. If it was a little further over, the president could likely be dead. And so there's no outrage at all, as far as I can tell. You know, I'm not getting all the coverage, you know, here in France. And again, a lot of it happened while I was asleep. But I'm going to have a lot more to say about this topic, you know, on my next podcast, when a lot more information is out. But one thing in particular is you got to admire Donald Trump and the way he's handled it and the courage that he showed in real time, in the moment when he was shot, not knowing how many more bullets were coming, just the way he handled it, the way he, you know, he raised his fist in the air in defiance, showing that I'm not going to be stopped. I mean, look at what this man has been put through legally and now, you know, almost murdered. You know, the left is doing everything they can. Not, you know, that I know that, you know, this was some kind of conspiracy yet. I mean, I'm not going to jump the gun and we'll see what comes out. But look at what he is going through. I may not agree with everything Trump does. And sure, I would have preferred it had he, you know, dramatically cut government spending or even cut government spending at all, because he didn't do that. He increased government spending. But of course, government spending would have increased even more had Clinton been elected. You know, I'm tired of seeing Democrats pointing out that how much the national debt went up under Trump, as if it would have gone up less under Clinton. It wouldn't have. I was disappointed that the president didn't do anything to reduce government spending. And I hope that in his second term, he actually does reduce dramatically government spending. I hope he does that. I know that if Biden were reelected, there'd be no hope at all that that would happen. But just the character of the man and the type of individual, more and more people now are starting to see that. I've seen now Elon Musk has come out and he's endorsed President Trump in the aftermath of this shooting. Bill Ackman just came out and endorsed President Trump. So more and more people now are jumping on the bandwagon. I think that image, that iconic image of the president with the flag in the background and his fist in the air and blood on his ear, I think that's going to be a big rallying cry. As that's the type of fighter, that's the type of courage, that's the type of man that we want leading the country. And hopefully in a second term, he has the wisdom to actually lead the country more in the direction that it needs to go in, because he is going to be encountering a major economic event during his presidency. He's not going to prevent it. You know, there are a lot of people who think, well, you know, it's a panacea. If we elect Trump, the problems are going to go away. The problems are not going to go away. The problems are here. They've been building for a long time, well before Trump took office. They may come to a head during his second term. So he's not going to stop the economic disaster from happening. But it's certainly going to be better to have him at the helm of the ship when it hits the iceberg, because then at least we have a chance of righting the ship and salvaging the economy and rebuilding on a firmer foundation. But anyway, that's it for now. The rest of the podcast is coming up. And again, I'll talk more about this on my next podcast, which should be live when I get back to the United States a week from today. Well, this is my second pre-recorded podcast. I am recording the podcast on Saturday afternoon. This is July 13th, and I'm doing it this way because I'm here in Turkey and we're 7 hours ahead, and I want to air it for the first time on Sunday night, but it's not a good time for me to do the podcast, so I'm doing it during the afternoon as a result of the time change. You know, I've never been to Turkey. This is my first trip here. I think I've kind of always meant to come here ever since I saw the James Bond movie From Russia with Love. I kind of wanted to visit Turkey, so I finally made it. I was in Istanbul immediately before I arrived here in Bodrum. This is our last day in Bodrum. And, you know, I never really knew about Bodrum, but we had some friends from Turkey that happened to be here. And I got to say, I really like the place. I would highly recommend it. It's, you know, very similar to the Greek islands in a way. Just as beautiful, in fact, more beautiful than some of them. Beautiful water, but also, you know, they've got a lot of good restaurants. There's a nightlife here. I think it's just as good, really, as going to those Greek islands. A little less crowded, less expensive. So I would certainly recommend Bodrum if you haven't heard of it and you want to come out to Europe. Actually, technically, we're in Asia, but we're very close to Europe. You know, Turkey is the continent that basically divides two continents. A little bit of it is in Europe, and then the majority of it is in Asia. But I can look out from the beach here, and you can actually see one of the Greek islands in the distance, so it's not too far. But anyway, the next podcast that I do, I should be back to a live podcast. I think I'm going to do the next one when I get back in Connecticut live on Sunday night. Between now and then, we're going to be in Paris and London and then home. But anyway, let me get into the main topic for today's podcast, and that is Jerome Powell's semi-annual testimony where he goes up to Capitol Hill and supposedly he answers questions from the representatives and the senators on the banking committee, the finance committee. But it really is just an opportunity for the congressmen and women to just grandstand and make little mini speeches for the audience. They don't really get any answers from Powell. In fact, Powell won't even give any answers to any pertinent questions, which is the most ridiculous aspect of this farce. Because you would think that the main purpose of having the Congress question Powell would be to get his take on the legislation that they're considering. Like, hey, we're thinking about this spending plan or this tax increase or tax cut or this new regulation. How do you feel that it would impact, you know, the economy? How would it impact inflation, interest rates? You would think that that should be the primary purpose of these meetings, right? So the people in the House and the Senate who are not necessarily there because they're great economists or financiers, because supposedly the Fed chairman got his job because he's the brightest of the bright, right? He's a super genius when it comes to finance and economics and money and inflation. And, you know, that's why he's got this important job. And so you would think that these congressmen and women who may have very little knowledge about, you know, economics and finance, here's their opportunity to kind of bounce some ideas off of Powell and find out, hey, you know, how would this impact the economy? We know you're trying to fight inflation. So what would be the impact of this new legislation? Or what could we do, right? Could you give us some advice? Right, what would you suggest we do to help fight inflation? You know, what recommendations would you have for us on fiscal policy? Right, you would think that that would be the purpose, but no. Anytime anybody asks Powell to comment on how a particular piece of legislation, whether it's fiscal policy or just, you know, a regulation, if they ask, well, how is that going to impact inflation? He says, well, I can't answer that. I'm not allowed to talk about that. I can't talk about fiscal policy because, you know, it's not my job. I wasn't elected, right? I want to stay in my lane. What do you mean it's not his job? Of course it's his job. His job is to educate Congress so that they understand the consequences of the stuff that they're doing. To say that I can't comment on it, if Powell thinks that a particular piece of legislation is bad, right, it's going to harm the economy, he's supposed to speak up. He's not supposed to say, well, I wasn't elected, so I can't talk. I mean, that's precisely why he can talk, because he wasn't elected. Look, these guys, Congress gets elected based on what the average American, right, thinks, which is doesn't know very much about economics, right, voting for these guys. So why not tell them the truth? Why not say, you know, that's a bad idea. You know, you should repeal what you just passed, or here's what you should do. He doesn't want to give any advice. I mean, he should be telling them, cut government spending dramatically. Look at these deficits. You're destroying the country. You want to know why there's so much inflation? Look in the mirror at all this government spending. But no, he just says, we take the fiscal policy as it's given to us. He said that multiple times. Like, we don't even care, right? Here I am, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. I couldn't give a damn about fiscal policy. It's just I take whatever I get, right? So if you want to hand me a $2 trillion deficit or a balanced budget, I'm indifferent, right? It doesn't matter to us, the Fed. We just take it as it's presented to us, and then we just do our job. No. You know, he talked about Volcker again. He brought his name up about how he did a good job and bringing down inflation. But Volcker also was very critical of the deficit spending that was going on during the 1970s and early 80s. And he was very specific in his warnings that government spending needed to be reduced, that we can't fight inflation with just monetary policy, that we need fiscal policy as well. We need contractionary fiscal policy, not these massive deficits. But Powell refuses to comment. And it's mainly because he doesn't want to be critical, right? He doesn't want to be accused of being partisan by criticizing any piece of legislation. But by doing that, it's a cop-out. And he is doing a gross disservice, not only to Congress, but to the American public. He should be speaking his mind, not biting his tongue. I mean, I'm sure he has an opinion. So share it. Share it with people who supposedly don't know nearly as much as you do about economics and about inflation. So enlighten them. Tell them what they're doing wrong, because they're doing a lot of stuff wrong. But anyway, so let me get a little bit more into the specifics of the 2-day event. And first of all, you know, all of the Democrats, when they give their little speeches, right, each congressman or senator gets to talk before they ask questions. And in fact, they talk so long, it's frustrating. They use up so much of their time talking that they don't even give Powell a chance to say anything. He barely has a chance, which I want to hear his answers or how he evades answering the questions, but I don't even get a chance, because by the time the congressman is finished making his speech, his time is up, and then we got to move on to the next guy. But all of the Democrats are blaming, or rather the Democrats are claiming the economy is great. One after another, we got a great economy, everything is great, and they credit Powell, but they also, of course, credit Biden. Thanks to Biden and his great policies, we've got this incredible economy with, you know, a low unemployment and inflation is coming down and everything is great. On the other hand, the Republicans talk about how lousy the economy is, how high inflation is, and they blame that on Biden. They don't blame the Fed at all. Nobody is blaming the Fed for anything. Everybody is talking about how great Powell is, what a great job he's done, what a great job the Fed has done. But the Republicans want to say the economy is horrible, inflation is high, and not hold the Fed accountable for its part of causing that problem. Because, of course, the Fed is very much to blame. It's not just the deficit spending of Biden. It's the monetary policy of the Fed. And of course, the Republicans never want to admit that a lot of the problem was caused prior to Biden becoming president, because just because we didn't see the inflation in the CPI when Trump was president doesn't mean that his deficit spending isn't partially responsible for the inflation that we're suffering now. Of course it is. And it's not just Trump, it's Obama and the Bushes. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. And of course, it's about to get a whole lot worse. You know, for all the congratulatory talk about how the Fed has succeeded, you know, Powell said in his prepared remarks that the Fed's tight monetary policy has really gone a long way in bringing inflation down from where it was to 3%-ish, wherever it is, and that we're on a glide path to 2%, and really claiming credit without understanding that all we've done is had a temporary transitory decline in the inflation rate, and it's about to accelerate. Now, I'm going to talk about the CPI and the PPI numbers that came out this week a little bit later in the podcast. But the point I want to make now is that it is a premature celebration to claim that the battle against inflation has been won when it's obviously been lost. But everybody wants to pretend that inflation is back in the bottle, the genie, because what they really want is rate cuts. They're trying to lay a foundation where the Fed can have cover to cut rates, not because the inflation battle has been won, but because fighting that battle has collateral damage for an overly leveraged economy, particularly the U.S. government, as interest payments on the national debt are exploding. And so there is massive pressure on the Fed to cut rates. So the Fed just needs an excuse, so it has cover to do that. You know, one of the best questions that we got, and it's something that I've been waiting a long time for. You know, I've talked on this podcast about, you know, I really wish somebody would ask this particular question. And he finally did. Powell finally got the question that I've been hoping that somebody would ask him. And in fact, I'm going to get into that. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. And on the other side, I'm going to tell you what that question was and why I was so disappointed in the answer.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messages so you can contact with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agreed Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join the 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. What I love most about Indeed is how simple it makes the hiring process and allows you to do all your hiring in one place. Candidates you invite to apply are three times more likely to actually apply for your job than the candidates who see it in search alone, according to U.S. Indeed data. Indeed gets you one step closer to the hire by immediately matching you with quality candidates. And now, listeners of my show can get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Just go to Indeed.com/Peter right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, then you need Indeed.
All right, so one of the questions that I've always wished somebody would ask Powell at either a press conference following, you know, a rate decision, or, you know, these Humphrey Hawkins, congressional testimonies, finally got asked. I forget which congressman asked the question, But he said, you know, when inflation was below 2% and it just moved above 2%, you said that your goal was average inflation rate of 2%. And so the Fed was going to target an inflation rate a little bit above 2% so that we could average the rate back down to 2%, because we had had so many years of 1.5, 1.75. So we needed a little bit higher than 2% to get an average. Remember, at the time when the Fed first announced this inflation averaging, I said it was all BS, that they didn't really want an average rate. They were just making an excuse to keep interest rates lower and to allow additional inflation. I always said that eventually inflation is going to be above 2% and they're going to give up that goal, because they're never going to try to run sub 2% inflation to average down high inflation the way they wanted to average up low inflation. So this congressman finally asked Powell, said, hey, whatever, you know, you said that you wanted average inflation of 2%. Well, we've had inflation well above 2% for years now. So does that mean you're going to target a rate slightly below 2% so that we can get the average down? And of course, it wouldn't have to be slightly below. We're so much further above 2% than we ever were below it. All the years where the Fed claimed, God, we just don't have enough inflation. We need 0% interest rates. We need quantitative easing because we need more inflation. It was barely below 2%. Of course, it was never below 2% because they weren't measuring it accurately. It was always above 2%. Every year they pretended that it was below, and they used that as justification to create more inflation. But now when we're at 6, 7, 8, 9%, we're miles above 2%. So in order to actually get the average down to 2%, we can't have 1.9, 1.8. We need inflation closer to zero. Maybe we need some deflation. We need falling prices a few years. It's going to take a lot of work to average what we've just experienced back down to 2%. And we're still getting inflation well above 2%. So he asked the question, does this mean that you have to target inflation below 2% so that we can get the average? And he had a one-word answer. He said, no. He was very emphatic. No. And that was it. Now, I really wish there was a follow-up. I wanted him to say, well, why? Why was it that we needed to average up low inflation, but we don't have to average down high inflation? I would love to hear Powell try to answer that question, because according to Powell, basically, low inflation is a bigger problem than high inflation, because if inflation is too low, we need to average it up. But if it's too high, we never need to average it down, right? It doesn't matter how many years inflation is way above 2%. We're never going to get inflation below 2% to make up for it. We're stuck with all that high inflation. And in fact, it's not even going to get to 2%, because Powell made it clear that when he talks about 2% inflation, he's not talking about the CPI. He's talking about the PCE. The personal consumption expenditure index. He said that that's what we're really targeting for 2%. And if you look at that, the PCE is running maybe about 0.5% below the CPI. And why is it that they want to use the PCE and not the CPI? Because the PCE is much lower than the CPI because it's even more rigged, right? It's the least accurate of all the inflation measures that the government uses. It's the one that is the lowest. And that's why it's the Fed's favorite, right? It's like, you know, if you're, you know, a kid in school, your favorite class is the one where you have the least amount of homework, right? You don't have to work as hard and you can get a good grade, right? It's like a Mickey Mouse course. So maybe that's the one that you like. Well, that's why the Fed likes the PCE, because, you know, grades on a curve. You don't really have to have low inflation, then you're going to get low inflation in the PCE because of the substitution and all the other stuff that goes into rigging that measure. But that's the one that the Fed is looking at. But even then, Powell admitted several times again, at testimony, that he's not going to wait for 2%. No, no, no. Because that's too risky. We can't wait for 2%, because if we wait for 2%, we may get below 2%. Well, why not? What's wrong with that? Right? Why can't we average down a little high inflation? He's already said, no, we can never do that. We can never average down high inflation. We have to make sure that we bounce off 2%, right? We don't want to go below it. That would be a disaster if we got to 1.9 or 1.8. So we can't have that. So what we have to do is when we think that we're probably going to head down to 2%, we're going to start cutting rates in anticipation that we're going to be on this glide path and we're going to get to 2%. Now, of course, they didn't have that type of thought on the way up. The Fed didn't say, you know, we better start hiking rates as we're getting closer to 2% because we don't want to overshoot. They had no problem overshooting 2% on the way up. But no, no, no. They want to make sure that there's no way they overshoot it on the way down. Again, this is all a bunch of BS. The government, Powell is just trying to justify creating more inflation, cutting interest rates, giving the economy the stimulus, like giving the drug addicts the drugs that he knows they need. So he's making up all these excuses so that the Fed could start cutting rates, even though inflation never even gets to 2%. But they're saying, we're going to assume that it's going to get there. The only reason we haven't started cutting is because we just need a little bit more data so that we know that the 3% inflation that we have now, you know, is going to get to 2%. We just need a little more data that we're headed in that direction. And then we can begin cutting rates in anticipation. But what if they're wrong, right? What if the Fed thinks that inflation is going to keep falling, right? What if it's at 2.7, 2.6, and Powell says, okay, we think it's going to go to 2, so let's start cutting rates now. Let's start easing up on our inflation fighting. And then everything turns around and we go back to 5 or 6% inflation. Then what is he going to do? You know, he's already thrown gasoline on the fire. You would think that they would be just as vigilant in getting inflation down and making sure it stays down as they were in getting inflation up. They wanted to make sure that inflation got above 2% and stayed there, or 2%. And they were willing to go above it. So why not be just as vigilant the other way? You know, it seems that when it comes to inflation, you know, for the American public, it's heads they lose, tails inflation wins, because you can never get low inflation. Because if we ever get low inflation, the Fed is determined to average it back up. So if we get lucky, we get a few years where inflation is low, well, now we've got to get high inflation to make up for that. But if we get a lot of years where inflation is high, we can never get years of really low inflation to make up for that. No, no, the Fed wants to make sure that it's 2%. But if it's 2%, we know it's not. It's much higher than 2%. And again, all of these numbers are rigged. If it's 2% in the PCE, it's probably 2.5%, 3% in the CPI. And then you got to double that, you know, 6% to get anything close to an actual rate of inflation. And that's what the Fed is really targeting. They're targeting high inflation. They're claiming that it's low inflation, but it's really a high amount of inflation. And the reason that the Fed wants inflation is because it wants to inflate away the debt. It wants to make it so that Congress doesn't have to cut government spending and make the difficult political choices. The Fed wants to help destroy the value of the currency and inflate away these obligations. And that's what's really going to happen. When the dollar really starts to fall, that's when you're going to start to see the inflation in the U.S. really start to pick up, because we've had these high inflation numbers during a period of time where the dollar has been relatively strong. Imagine how much worse it's going to get when the dollar is weak. Now, we're not going to have to imagine that for much longer, because I think the dollar is going to be very weak. In fact, I think 2025 could be one of the worst years yet for the U.S. dollar. I mean, it's kind of defied gravity, but a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's so many problems in other countries that people have been taking refuge in our currency. But I think that's going to flip once the Fed is cutting rates, and more importantly, once they go back to quantitative easing, which is around the corner. I think they may restart quantitative easing, before the end of this year. But then I think the bottom is going to drop out of the dollar. In fact, you know, when Powell was talking about the balance sheet, he was asked what size the balance sheet needs to be. Because, you know, they've tapered now their quantitative tightening. And he wouldn't specify a number, but he said we need to have an ample balance sheet. We need our balance sheet to be plentiful. What the hell does that mean? And first, why? Why does it have to be so ample and so plentiful? I mean, what he means is that it's never going back down to where it was, which, of course, is the opposite of what Bernanke claimed when he said that they weren't monetizing the debt. When he said all the bonds that we're buying, we're going to sell, so we're not a banana republic. Now you have Powell say, no, no, we want ample reserves. We want plentiful reserves. I guess that means trillions and trillions and trillions on the balance sheet. And we're not going down to where we were, which, again, is something that I said from the very beginning. You know, one of the most frustrating things, too, about this is how Powell repeatedly blamed inflation on the pandemic. That was it, right? Like, the Fed had nothing to do with it. You know, it was all the pandemic, right? Because the pandemic meant that people weren't working and they weren't producing. And then we reopened the economy and everybody had all this money to spend. But where'd they get all that money? They got it from the government, right? So isn't it the government's fault, you know, that everybody had all this money to spend even though they weren't producing? And then he says, you know, there were supply shortages. It wouldn't have mattered if there were supply shortages if the government didn't create all this money. And in fact, when Powell says it's not up to him to tell the government to cut spending, why during pandemic did he tell the government to raise spending? I remember him specifically saying, hey, increase spending and we're going to print money. We're going to monetize the debt. He encouraged all that reckless deficit spending that he's now saying caused the inflation without accepting responsibility. Because, oh, it's just the pandemic. The pandemic did it. No, the pandemic didn't do anything. It was the way the government responded to the pandemic. That asinine combination of monetary and fiscal policy, that was the problem. And the Fed bears a lot of the responsibility, and Powell is willing to accept none of it. He's just claiming, oh, it's this pandemic, came out of left field. That's why we have inflation. I mean, to a lesser extent, he blamed it on Putin invading the Ukraine, right? So, but no, not accepting any responsibility. And again, the Republicans don't want to blame him because they want to blame it all on Biden. And the Democrats, they don't want to blame him because they want to say everything is great. So he gets out of there scot-free. The only person who criticized him was Elizabeth Warren, you know, and her criticism was asinine. And I could see him getting frustrated by the things that she was accusing him of doing. You know, she's really upset that the banks are taking a lot of risk, that executives are taking a lot of risk and getting big bonuses. And she thinks the government, the Fed, should do something about that. Look, the reason the banks take so much risk is because the government guarantees the deposits. That is the problem. It's not capitalism. Elizabeth Warren is right. There's too much risk taking at the banks. I agree with her there. But the reason there's so much risk taking is the moral hazard created by the government that she created by backstopping all these banks, by telling all the bank customers, you don't have to worry about your bank failing because we're going to bail you out. Everything is insured by the government. That's what's causing all the risk. If the government didn't do that, if we had a free market in banks, and I've talked about this multiple times, I wrote about it, you know, in my books, it was a big part of Crash Proof or The Real Crash. If we had a free market and depositors had to shop around because they were concerned about the risks that the banks took with their deposits, because when you're a bank depositor, you're a creditor of that bank. You're lending your money to the bank. You're an unsecured creditor, you're a depositor. And therefore, you should be concerned about the type of loans, the type of risk that the bank is taking with your money. But nobody is concerned about those risks because the government said, don't be concerned. Just put your money anywhere. Doesn't matter. The bank fails. You're going to get your money back. So there is no competition for safety, right? Imagine if that happened, you know, with other products, right? People do a lot of research before they buy let's say, a television set. You know, they go online, they look at consumer reports, they look at reviews, they want to find out which ones have a better picture, which one is more reliable. You know, same thing, or you buy a car. Think of how much you test drive, you go from dealership to dealership, you do a lot of research. Well, people don't do any research before they put hundreds of thousands of dollars in a bank. But if the government basically said, hey, just go buy any TV, and if anything goes wrong, we'll fix it for you. You know, buy a car, you don't need a warrant. If anything goes wrong, we got it covered. Right? Well, people wouldn't shop around if the government said, don't worry, if anything goes wrong, we'll just reimburse you and make you whole. Right? We want people to shop around. They used to shop around before Roosevelt screwed it all up. But at least when Roosevelt put the deposit insurance, it was a very low number. And what Roosevelt thought was that, okay, the little guy doesn't know which banks are good, but the bigger depositors do. And they'll keep all the banks honest. The large depositors, you know, they'll shop around. They'll make sure the banks aren't taking on too much risk, except the government now basically bails out everybody. Every bank that has failed, nobody has lost money. Didn't matter how much they had there, they fully covered everybody. And so it's massive moral hazard. The reason the executives take this risk is because the government makes it possible. So don't blame the banks for exploiting the game that you rigged. If you don't like what they're doing, then stop subsidizing it. Eliminate the guaranteed deposits, and then you'll eliminate the excessive risk-taking because the customers won't let them do it. They won't have any customers if they take excessive risk. The only way that you could get rid of it now is even more regulation. But that's, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. But the problem is, if you don't have the second wrong, you're going to have problems. But more regulation just ushers in even worse problems than that. The other thing that I thought was interesting, maybe interesting isn't the word for it, but one of the senators, I think it was the Senate, when this came up, talked about the fact that in the most recent jobs report, that like 30% of the jobs came from government, and that another 20-30% was in healthcare, which he said was also government, which is true. And he said, isn't this a problem that these jobs are coming from government spending, so they're only here because of the deficit spending? And Powell kind of acknowledged that it was a little bit problematic only because he would prefer to see more broad-based job creation, that it would be, you know, more spread out and diversified among other sectors. You know, they mentioned that manufacturing lost jobs, right? That's not the problem. It's not about that it's a concentration of jobs in government and healthcare, right? The problem is that government and healthcare jobs are not productive, right? And they're being paid for by the government, by the taxpayer, by deficits. That is a huge problem. Private sector jobs pay for themselves, and their employers get the money from the productivity of the workers. But government gets the money to pay its workers by running deficits, by creating inflation. That's what's going on. Nobody even brought out the problem between a productive private sector job and a non-productive government job. In fact, Powell even denied that healthcare jobs were related to the government. Of course they are. The reason we have so many healthcare jobs is because the government is spending so much money on healthcare. The government gives people all kinds of money, Medicaid, Medicare, Obamacare, and they take that money and they buy health services. And so the money is being directed to healthcare by the government. And so those jobs are being created in the sector that the government is subsidizing. And Powell didn't even see the connection. He was like, well, I don't see how that's related in any way to government. I mean, is he really that clueless that he doesn't see that? But it, you know, again, the other part was he didn't get the connection between the lack of productivity, because where are the products going to come from that the government workers and the healthcare workers buy if they're not producing them? They're going to come from imports. So we're going to have bigger trade deficits. So the type of jobs that we are creating, as I've said, lead to larger budget deficits and larger trade deficits. So the twin deficits get bigger. That puts more downward pressure on the dollar, more upward pressure on consumer prices. You would think that Powell would understand this and that he would, yes, agree, this is problematic. We need private sector jobs. We need goods producing jobs, not goods consuming jobs. But he wasn't even able to make the connection. Anyway, I want to move forward, though, from what Powell was saying to what Biden, because there was a press conference that I caught. I didn't catch it live because I was asleep based on the time, you know, change here. So I got to that on YouTube the following morning. But Biden was supposed to have this big boy press conference, right, where he was going to face the press and prove to the American public that what happened during the debate was like a fluke, because he just was sick because of all that jet lag. You know, he was flying around all over the world and, you know, he had a bad night, right? Just a little off night. And so here's his chance to face the press. And most of the press conference was him reading off a teleprompter about, you know, how great everything was. And, you know, when it comes to inflation, too, he says, you know, we've got inflation down, but, you know, those greedy corporations are still gouging, right? I forget the exact words that he used, but he said, I've got more work to do to get these greedy corporations to lower their prices. So basically, the only reason we have inflation is corporate greed. I mean, that's basically something he laid out, and that he's succeeded so far in reining in that greed. Like, he had conversations with all these greedy corporate executives and he got them to stop hiking their prices. But, you know, he's still not finished, right? There's still a few holdouts that are sticking it to the customers. And so he just needs a little bit more time to get this done. In fact, he did talk about price controls, national rent control. I've been saying this is coming and we will get it. You know, if by some crazy fluke, Biden or Kamala Harris is the next president, we are going to have price controls. But he talked about it on rent. He said that he wants to make it so no landlord can raise your rent by more than 5% a year. Now, of course, that's completely unconstitutional, but who knows? I mean, in fact, I want to get to a Supreme Court decision that I didn't even notice it came out. In fact, I'm going to talk about it later in the podcast because I've been traveling. It was a horrible decision. And so a Supreme Court that can come up with that decision may allow, you know, rent controls under some perversion of the Commerce Clause, but it's coming. And it's not just rent controls, but it's going to be price controls on all sorts of stuff because the government wants to blame inflation that they create on businesses that have no choice but to raise prices because their costs, which are also prices, have gone up and that they need to stay in business. They need to have a profit and they can't do that unless they pass on their increased costs that were caused by the government-created inflation to the end consumer. But most of Biden's press conference was Biden reading off a teleprompter. Then he finally got to the questions. And the first thing he said, and I would have imagined he wasn't supposed to say this, like he was supposed to keep it a secret. But the first thing he said is, hey, I've got a list of reporters that I'm allowed to call on. And so I'm going to read the reporters off this list. Now, I don't know if he was supposed to admit that, but in a press conference, you're not supposed to decide in advance, like who you're going to, ask a question to. I mean, I'm supposedly everybody's supposed to have a fair shot, right? Everybody's supposed to be there with their hands up. I mean, there's hundreds of reporters in this room. Most of them are just wasting their time because they're not on the list. There's a list of friendly reporters. How is this a big boy press conference when he's only going to take softballs from his buddies, right? So they're calling on reporters. Now, for all I know, these reporters have given them the questions in advance, like he got the debate questions in advance and still couldn't handle them. I don't know. But he has a list of reporters that he's going to call on. So he starts going down the list. And the funny thing, the very first gaffe he makes, or the very first question, is he calls his vice president Trump. Didn't even realize he made the mistake. Didn't go back and correct it the way he went back and corrected calling Zelensky Putin, right? Earlier, he had made that mistake and corrected himself. He didn't correct himself. I mean, the last reporter that he asked a question pointed that out. He said, hey, you called Donald Trump your vice president. He's making a big deal about that. That was, I think, the 10th reporter. And as soon as it started getting a little dicey, his handlers were like, okay, that's it. Press conference is over. It came to an abrupt end. He only took 10 questions from these reporters who had been handpicked in advance. Everybody else was just there for theater, just to make it look like a press conference, right? They should have just had those 10 reporters in an empty room, but they wanted to make it look like, you know, he was actually facing the press. He wasn't, right? He didn't have any real serious questions to deal with. So I think the whole thing was a farce, but it didn't do anything, I think, to improve his standing. I mean, he didn't completely fall apart at the press conference, but it should be obvious to the people who watch this highly scripted event that Biden can't stand up to a legitimate press conference, and he can't, field questions off the cuff from reporters who weren't already pre-approved. And in fact, I don't know if he had an ear pierce. There's some rumors that, you know, there were people talking into his ear, and so giving him hints on, you know, when to talk or when to cut it off. I don't know. You know, it was like some kind of Cyrano de Bergerac thing going on where, you know, somebody is helping him answer these questions and telling him, you know, when to stop talking. He's going off on a tangent. I don't know. But the whole thing is ridiculous. Anyway, I want to get before I do the economic stuff, let me get to that Supreme Court decision that I talked about. Because I talked about this Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Moore, a while ago. And U.S. versus Moore, I thought, was a very important case. And I don't want to, you know, really run up the length of this podcast by getting into it. But it has to do with the government's taxing power, where the government tried to redefine income. Because the 16th Amendment is very specific in that only income can be taxed as a direct tax without apportionment. Because the Constitution says that all direct taxes need to be apportioned. In fact, it's the only thing that Constitution says twice, right? So if the Founding Fathers wrote that in there twice, it was important. Direct taxes must be apportioned. That was changed with the 16th Amendment, in theory, with respect to income taxes, but just income taxes, nothing else. And therefore, what income is very important, because the only type of tax, direct tax, that doesn't have to be apportioned is an income tax. Well, what the U.S. government now did, because they won this case, it was a 7-2 decision in favor of the government, is the income is now expanded to mean maybe an unrealized gain. This could be paving the way for a future wealth tax, a tax on unrealized appreciation, which clearly is not income. Income is a gain. You don't have a gain unless you actually receive something. And in the case of the Moors, they were taxed on the fact that they owned shares of a corporation, even though they hadn't sold the shares or received a dividend. And this clearly is a direct tax on their property. They were being taxed because they owned shares of a company, not because they got any income derived from that ownership, but simply because they owned it. So it was a property tax, not an income tax. They were taxed because they owned property. And only two justices, Clarence Thomas, who wrote the dissent, and I haven't had a chance to read it, I'm planning on doing that, and Neil Gorsuch, were the only two justices that had any integrity or any understanding of the Constitution or the guts to rule that this is unconstitutional. And now the court has expanded broadly the government's taxing authority. And the way the media reports this, oh, this is good news. This is horrible news. This means that all Americans are less free than they were because the government now has broader powers to tax us, right? The whole idea behind the Constitution was to limit government, limit how much government can spend, and limit the ways that it can tax us. And direct taxes are potentially very abusive. You know, indirect taxes, sales taxes, stuff like that, they're self-corrective because you can avoid those taxes by not buying the products that are subject to the tax. So they're self-correcting. The government raises the tax too much, they don't collect any revenue. But direct taxes are much harder to avoid because they fall directly on you. And therefore, they are much more prone to be abusive. And now, to allow the government to claim that we have income when we don't, so that we can be taxed on our property, opens up a whole new taxing. You know, we don't have any federal property tax. You ever notice that, right? Your local government taxes your property, but you don't get a federal property tax. Why does the federal government not have a property tax? Because they can't do it, because it has to apportion it. Well, now they may be able to do it. Now that the Supreme Court has opened up the door and allowed this obviously unconstitutional tax to stand by broadening the definition of income. It's not really income anymore, right? Because the Moores didn't get any income. A company that they owned may have had some income, but they didn't get the income. They didn't receive any of the income, but now all of a sudden they're subject to the income tax. So this is a horrible decision, probably one of the worst decisions that the high court has ever handed down. And they've handed down a lot of very bad decisions. A couple of Trump's appointees went the other way, right? He appointed Neil Gorsuch, and now he was a dissent. But Clarence Thomas is by far, he's the best justice we got. You know, I wish we had 9 Clarence Thomases on the Supreme Court instead of just 1. But horrible, horrible decision. Again, I don't want to get into it again because it's a long podcast. I talked at length about this. I forget the podcast numbers. Maybe we could figure it out. And I'll put a link in the description where I talk more about direct, indirect taxes. I talk more about the Moore case. And it's really unfortunate that it went the way it did. We needed 3 more justices to flip. I mean, we had conservative justices. It's unfortunate that they didn't stick to those principles and they allowed the government to usurp more power than is authorized by the Constitution. And so whenever the government gains power, we lose freedom. You know, we are less free today as Americans than we were before this decision came out. Anyway, I want to get to the economic data and the markets. The big news that came out moving the markets was the inflation numbers. That's what everybody was waiting for. And we got the CPI numbers on Thursday. And those numbers came out well below estimates. And the market loved that. Instead of a 0.1% rise or 0 to 0.2, we got a 0.1% drop in the CPI. So a negative number. Year over year went from 3.3 last month to 3.0, which was less than had been expected. In fact, it was lower than the lower end of expectations, which was 3.1 to 3.3. The core up just 0.1 versus 0.2 expectations, and year over year core went down to 3.3 from 3.4. So this was great news, right? Inflation is lower. The Fed can cut rates. Markets, you know, love the news. Gold was up about 40, 50 bucks on the day. The dollar was down. Everybody, you know, liked this. Although there was a sell-off in the NASDAQ. The Russell 2000 had a huge rally on Thursday as the NASDAQ went down. It was one of the biggest divergences we've ever seen between the small cap and the NASDAQ. And they've kind of been diverging. But then after we got the better than expected CPI number on Thursday, we got a worse than expected PPI number on Friday, where the June producer prices were up 0.2, which was double the 0.1 that was estimated. And they revised the prior month's minus 0.2 to 0. And the year over year number, which was supposed to be 2.3, went to 2.6. And the prior year-over-year number was revised from 2.2 to 2.4. This is a really bad number. And again, is a leading indicator of higher CPI. The core was supposed to be up 0.2. It was up 0.4. And they revised up the prior month from 0 to up 0.3. And the year-over-year core rose all the way to 3%. It was 2.3% in May. It was supposed to be 2.3% in June. It was 3%. This was a horrible number. This is one of the worst PPIs, relative consensus, that you could imagine. And initially, gold was down about 20 bucks, not that much. No real rally in the dollar. And the markets just rallied. In fact, by the end of the day, the Dow was up better than, well, actually, it was up over 400 at one point. It didn't close up that high, but it hit a new all-time record high. Finally, the Dow, despite this horrible number, hit a new all-time record high. In fact, the Dow closed above 40,000 for the first time ever. We had traded above 40,000 a couple of times, but we never closed above 40,000. So I think the market pretty much realizes that rates are coming down. We're going to cut rates. Doesn't matter what these numbers are. It's good enough for government work. The inflation numbers are good enough that Powell is going to start cutting. I mean, that's what he's set up, and that's what's going to happen. And that's why the market went up. The S&P hit a record high. The Russell 2000 was the star on the week for the broader index. It was up 5.1% on the week. Dow was only up about 1%. S&P up about 0.2%. The NASDAQ, though, was barely up because of the big drop on Thursday. It only finished maybe up 0.1 on the week and didn't set a record. But the stars were the mining stocks. Again, had a great week last week, strong week. Gold up 1.5%, closed above 2,400 at 2,410. Didn't make a new all-time record high. We closed, maybe got about $20 away from a new record high gold price. Silver backed off a bit. It was down about 1%. But remember, it was up like 6% last week. So it had a little bit of a pullback. But the mining stocks were very strong, even though they were down slightly on Friday. The GDX was up 6% on the week. The GDXJ was up 6.2%. And unlike gold, these indexes hit 52-week highs not only on Friday, they hit 52-week highs on Thursday. So for a long time, the gold stocks have been lagging the metal. This is the first time in years that the gold stocks are leading the metal. And I think this is the beginning of a new trend. I think that gold stock investors are finally starting to wake up to the reality that this bull market in gold is real and that it's got a long way to go. Because normally, during a bull market, this is typical. The stocks normally lead the metal. What's been so unique about this bull market, one of many things that have been unique, is it's been the other way around. The metal has been dragging the miners reluctantly. There has been no enthusiasm in the investors. They're not anticipating higher gold prices. They're worried that we're going to get lower gold prices. And so they don't want to buy the stocks. They're nervous about buying the gold stocks. Well, now they're a little bit less nervous because the gold stocks finally broke out to new highs, even without the price of gold itself breaking out to new highs. So now the gold stock investors are anticipating a breakout. And I think they finally got it right. I expect the price of gold to hit a new all-time record high next week. And I think we're going to keep moving up. Also, the dollar is breaking down just as gold is breaking out. Dollar index closed, I think, 103.75. Had a lot of weakness against the Japanese yen this week. There was some Bank of Japan intervention, although this time it actually succeeded in driving the dollar down. But the euro closed the week above 109. This is the highest it's been, I think, in several months, maybe since April. You know, my restaurants might be a little bit more expensive now because the euro is going up. But to me, this, you know, this makes sense that these things are happening together, that the dollar is rolling over and about to break down just as gold is about to break out. One thing that is not breaking out, not following real gold, is fool's gold. Bitcoin had really a non-event during the week. I think the Bitcoin ETFs managed to eke out a 0.8% gain on the week. As I'm reporting, or as I'm recording this podcast on Saturday afternoon, Bitcoin's about 58,000, 750. So really not participating in the rally that you're seeing in precious metals. I still think that we're getting ready for another big decline in Bitcoin. In fact, I noticed during the week that Michael Saylor announced that they were going to be having a split of MicroStrategy stock, even though the stock is 35% below its high for the year, which is rare. I mean, yes, it's a high price. The stock is around, what, 1,300 or something a share. So, you know, you oftentimes stocks that are that expensive will split. But the high was almost 2,000. But the interesting thing is the stock's in a bear market. I don't know what I've seen a stock split that was in a bear market. Normally, when the stock is splitting, they announce that as the stock is making new highs, not when it's 35% below its prior high and clearly in a bear market. So I think, you know, they're trying to generate some interest in that stock because I think there's a lot of negative pressure on a MicroStrategy. And again, as I pointed out, a lot of the people who are short MicroStrategy own Bitcoin. And if MicroStrategy really tanks and they want to cover and take their profits, well, they're also going to be selling their Bitcoin. And that's a lot of Bitcoin that's going to be hitting the market, in addition to the German government Bitcoin, in addition to the Mt. Gox Bitcoin. But the real problem for Bitcoin is when those ETF buyers who have continued to buy, they were buying all week. They didn't help. They didn't push the price up because there was selling to offset it. But the ETF buyers are still there propping up the market. But when these buyers turn into sellers, there is nothing left and the market's going to collapse and Bitcoin's going through the floor. So before that happens, you know, it's not too late to get rid of your fool's gold and get some real gold, get some silver. You know, silver's still below $32 an ounce. Shift Gold, we were one of the first companies to start working with BitPay. So you can go to Shift Gold, go on our website, and you can use your Bitcoin to the extent that my audience still has any Bitcoin. But if you do, this is a great time before the bottom drops out of Bitcoin and gold goes through the roof to use the Bitcoin and convert them into gold, convert them into silver. And again, the mining stocks, they're just starting to move. They've got such a long way to go. Look at a chart of these mining stocks. Look at a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year chart to really appreciate just how cheap these stocks are and that they're really just starting to move. If we're really just starting this bull market, because we're finally, after all these years, we're leading the gold price higher, then this is going to be a massive move up. And you really want to get exposure to the sector. And you need to look at the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Go to my website. It's europac.com. And you can get information. You can buy my gold fund no load at any discount broker, Schwab, Fidelity, all the other smaller discount brokers. We're on all those platforms before the prices get much higher. Yeah, read the perspective. It's a lot riskier when you buy mining stocks than when you buy metals, which I regard as an alternative to cash, as a long-term store of value. Mining stocks, you know, these are risky businesses. But the key to me when I'm speculating is how much upside potential do I have versus the downside risk? And I think it is so skewed right now that it's such a good bet. Yeah, you can lose money, but what you can lose pales in comparison to how much you can make. So if you're ever going to gamble on anything, this is the time, and gold stocks are the assets that you want to choose. I mean, it's not just a gamble. It is a very wise speculation, right? Gambling is just pure chance. Like it's just random luck. But when you speculate, there's a logic behind it, right? You can make a prudent speculation. Maybe you're wrong and you lose money, but if you're right, you can make a killing. And this is the time to concentrate those bets if you have the risk tolerance to lose money. Anyway, that's it for today's podcast. Again, if you enjoyed it, don't forget to leave a comment, like it, you know, give me the thumbs up, whatever it is. And the next podcast I do should be back home in Connecticut at the end of this trip, and it will be a live one. So until then, bye for now.